Good afternoon. Is that working? Are we on yet? Hello, hello. No? Up, 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 up. How's that? Better? Good. Hi. I am stunned. Look at that sea of eager, test-driven faces. That's great. My name is David Starr. This is Josh Weber. What do you do, Josh?
I'm a program manager for Visual Studio.
ALM tools specifically.
ALM tools.
What's that ALM stuff?
Application Lifecycle Management.
Well, we got a new TLA. And we are doing that for a while. And today we're going to talk about these things, stubs, shims, and emulators. This emulators thing is something that's fairly new to us. And Josh's team's been working on that. We've had stubs and shims for a little while, but most people don't know exactly what they are, what they're for, and how to use them. We're going to go through that today. And I'm really excited, actually, because today is my one-month anniversary as a Microsoft employee.
Woo!
Market.
And my boss made me come do this. Thanks, Peter. Okay, so here's the idea. We need to test our software, obviously, and we want to test it in isolation. Isolation is the key here. And these technologies, stubs, shims, and emulators, help us do that. These guys are working on the robotic arm that goes on one of the Mars rovers. And in order to test this arm, they actually are sending signals, you might see there at the bottom right, through electrical control box to the arm. Those aren't real instructions coming from the brain of that bot that'll be there later. It's a simulation environment. We're going to do the same thing with our stub shims and emulators. Now, before we get started with that part of the discussion, I've got some things that I'll just blindly assert because it's fun to watch you glare at me. Number one, this. And I'll bet you, though, that for the folks who are in this room, you buy this too. It's a very simple assertion. Our quality is lower when we don't have as much coverage. Now, I'm not trying to draw a specific correlation that says high code coverage or high test coverage equals high quality, but we do know that the inverse is probably true. We also know this, that when code is hard to test, specifically when it's hard to isolate, we're much less likely to take the time and energy and money to test it. And unfortunately, we don't take the time to, I would call it, decouple that pile of goo to test it. And the things that we have often run slow. Sometimes we have to apply really complex test techniques to it. And when we have that, or when things are slow, we consider those things hard to test. And so we've already said if things are hard to test, we kind of won't test them because it's just a pain, so we won't do it. Michael Feathers talks about legacy code this way. I buy this. I actually went out and looked at what it means for, what does legacy code mean? It turns out this definition of legacy code has evolved over the years. We used to talk about a legacy code as being code that is no longer running, and then it was code that is on a system that we will no longer support. Now, it is not an uncommon assertion that all code not covered by tests is legacy code. You're starting to hear this more and more. Here's the unfortunate truth in my experience, and I'll bet it's in yours too. So, what are we going to do about that? Well, if we were starting with a clean slate, we all know exactly what we'd do. We'd have some object. We're going to make it, and it's brand new. It's so clean. Look at that field of driven snow. We're going to insert into it our very first method, and when we do that, hopefully because we're good test-driven developers, right about at the same time, we're going to invoke some operation with a test against that method. Now, this is all usually fine and good. The unfortunate truth, though, is that lying somewhere inside that object that we're testing is perhaps some other dependency, some internal member. Maybe it's private. Maybe I can't see it from my test. And it just so happens that method A knows about it, so method A talks to it. Not such a big deal, except that, oh, object 2 has one of his own dependencies, and there's a dependency chain now that I'm three levels deep, and uh-oh, the real truth is that. Right? Ugh. So what do we do about it? Well, we do that. we put in an alternative implementation of whatever that dependency is so that we can check that method A is actually doing what we expect it to do. This is all we mean when we talk about isolation. Now, there are three technologies we'll talk about here, one being stubs, and stubs are this. Stubs are a technology used to provide a fake instance of a class, typically through the interface that our method might depend on. And we organize our code typically like this. We might have some interface. And this is only what we get to do, by the way, if we design well from the beginning. We have our interface, iConference in this case. And we have a concrete implementation class. And perhaps we have a fake conference implementation. So this iConference implementation on the right is something that is scoped only to my test project, right? And then I'll take that thing and I will pass it in to the thing that I'm actually testing, of course, which is the conference scheduler. We're going to jump over to some code. And this is a really complex domain that we built for ourselves here. We have a city zoo. Now, I moved here from Boise, Idaho. And in Boise, you, as you might expect, our zoo is privatized. However, I'm in Washington State now. And so not only can we tell the number of animals and can we add animals to the zoo, but we can listen to the animals in their chorus when they all talk together. And unfortunately, this particular zoo takes a dependency on a public facility context object, because it's a public zoo. That public facility context object is something that you have to take dependencies on all the time. It is HTTP context. It is activity context. It is whatever gets injected into the thing that you're writing that you have to deal with. So we'll have to find a way to deal with the fact that we are a public-facing zoo. Now, the first thing I might want to do here is add an animal to the zoo. Seems simple enough. So we're going to pretend that I'm driving out my system under test at the same time that I'm creating my tests. In this case, we'll start with a zoo, and we want to put an animal into it. When we do so, let's see here. We start to put in an iAnimal, and we'll call this some sort of animal. It doesn't really matter what kind. And look at that. There are the animals that I have access to up here in my system under test solution. These are concrete classes, concrete implementations. Now, what happens if I use one of those to test the zoo? Well, it turns out that I'm taking a dependency on whatever that concrete object is, which means I'm not just testing the zoo anymore. Now I'm unfortunately testing the interaction between whatever that animal is in the zoo, so I would prefer to isolate it. And so to do that, what I will typically do is come down here and make something like this. That's why we have test lab rats, right? Because they're disposable. So here's my disposable animal. Well, I had to make this one myself. And this is one thing that we do a lot of in our test projects. We actually implement that interface. We have a fake now, and we pass it in. So here we go. We're going to do that. So we're going to just new up our lab rat, and then we'll pass it into the zoo. And hopefully, now, our test will pass. Let's come over here to our unit test explorer. There we go. So we've got our very first unit test passing here. The next thing we might want to do is stop rolling those things by hand. Do you have a solution for that, Josh?
I think I might.
What's it called?
Fakes, or more specifically, stubs.
So stub is a type of fake?
Stub is a type of fake.
Fake being any kind of thing that we're going to pass into our system under test that's not real, right? Like these things that we've been talking about. So I want to create a fake iAnimal, but I don't want to have to code it up. Here's what I might then instead do. Note that I'm in my zoo specs project because the specs are the tests and the tests are the specs. You know that, right? We all agree?
That was quiet.
If it's just written on a Word document, you can't compile it. That's a desirement. All right. So what we want to do is have Visual Studio generate our lab rat. And to do so, we'll right-click on Zoo, and we'll say Add Fakes Assembly. We'll add this assembly, and look at that. Boom, a couple of things just happened over here in Solution Explorer. First thing that happened is we got a new assembly. The other thing that happened is we got a little file here. It actually added a folder and then a file to my project. Here is the internal of that file. What is this, Josh?
This is the fakes configuration file.
So it's sort of like a little meta file or a driver file, a packaging file, if you will, for the assembly that we just created. Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, Visual Studio created this handy little assembly. Let's take a look at what's inside of it. Here we are. And it turns out that inside this zoo fakes, we have a stub iAnimal, but it's not an interface anymore. Now that's a concrete class. So that's a concrete class inside this thing that was generated, and I get to use it to pass into my zoo. So I could do, for example, this. I could say zoo.addAnimal, and I could new up one of these stub iAnimals. And because my test is actually calling for us to put three animals in and count them that way, I will do it a couple times. That was one too many. There we go. Let's try and run our test and see what happens. Now, one thing that's true at this point is that we're incurring a little bit of overhead. Not a lot, but a little bit, right? Because we've got a little bit more code in our project. How often does that thing get generated, that assembly, Josh?
It's just generated one time at build time, and selectively generated only when you change an underlying assembly.
Okay, so it's not going to change that assembly every time, only when it needs to because I've made a change to the thing that I'm actually faking out, yeah?
That's correct.
Ah, well, that's not so bad. And it turns out that that assembly sitting on the file system right now is just that, is an assembly on the file system. We're not doing anything weird there. It is compiled along with my project. Right?
Has so, a custom build target, compiles right along with the rest of the project.
Right on. So this is important because it means we're not doing anything fancy, like we're not jumping into the IL code. We're not being intrusive to the system under test. Okay, so that worked great. Well, let's make the animals talk a little bit. So let's go to our next test. What I may want to do is actually test the fact that I can hear, or that the zoo, whenever I tell it I want to listen to the chorus of animals, asks the animals to talk. So, of course, we're going to take advantage of our lab, or our fake lab rat again. So we'll call this an animal equals new, and we're going to use that stub. I haven't taken the dependency on that thing yet. So this is a stub I animal. There we are. Now, if we look into the internal of Zoo Listen to the Animals, let's go see what it does. What it does is it says, for every animal that I have in the zoo, I'm going to ask that animal to speak. And I'm going to add that voice to the chorus, and we'll listen to the whole thing. And it's a cacophony of wilderness love, right? Well, what happens when I call speak on this generated animal? He's not going to know what his voice sounds like. He's not going to know how to respond. So I have to tell him how to respond. And I do that by saying, oh, keep me honest there, Josh. Speak plus equals, and I'm going to provide my own implementation. And what I'm going to do is return what my assertion at the bottom is already asking for, which is the animal screaming the word fake. And we'll run our test. Oh, something didn't work properly. What'd I do? Oh, I haven't actually added the animal. That would probably be important.
So we'll add the animal to the zoo. We'll say zoo run it. Yep. Checking all my context there, and I think we're going to be good this time. Excellent. So it turns out that we can actually add behaviors to these stubs so that we can tell the system under test exactly what we know it wants to hear. I could go a lot of places with that one, but anyway. All right, what's the next thing we might do? Well, sometimes people, instead of wanting, or being in the position, I should say, of wanting to know what the dependency did, they want to know how my system under test interacted with it. This is called a behavioral verification style test. What that means is I'm going to set some expectations on this fake thing that I've created. I'm going to give it to the system under test. And when I get it back, I'm going to look at the fake thing and say, what did the system under test do to you? And I'll make assertions about that. This turns out to be, if you do this for a while, a terrible idea. Because what it in effect does is it locks your implementation of listen to the animals into a contract, and now you can't change your algorithm unless you also change the corresponding test. Yet, there are plenty of good arguments for doing this. And the question now is, can we do it with fakes? Or can we do it with stubs? And it turns out we can a little bit. So what I'm going to do here is cheat, because you guys don't want to watch me type. And it would be awesome if I would be able to paste everything I needed. There we go. Okay, so we have a new animal, a new stubbed animal, and not only are we going to tell it to speak, but when we tell it to speak, we're going to flip a locally scoped variable that tells me indeed it spoke, and then we assert against that variable. This is a very different thing now, isn't it? What we're checking is, how did the system under test, the zoo, interact with the animal? And this is called a spy. So there's this whole discussion about what types of fakes there are out there in the world. It's a fun language to talk, too. It's things like dummies, fakes, spies, et cetera,
test
right?
Doubles.
Test doubles, that's mocks. A good one. Mocks. So what we're doing right now is called a spy. That's a stub with a little bit of behavior that tracks state about what happens to it. The next logical extension of that is a mock, and we'll get to that later. As a matter of fact, I think we're going to get to it now.
Okay.
So the next thing we might want to do is, instead of checking the internal variable that we set up, let's come down here to this next test. I'm going to do this by hand real quick, just in a different way. We'll say zoo equals new city zoo. There we go. We're still testing that guy. And now I'm going to do it my animal. And of course, I'm going to use that good old stub iAnimal. This time we're going to do something a little bit different, though. What's that property on there, Josh, that instance observer? What is that?
Instance observer watches the behavior of the stub.
Watches the behavior of the stub. But it's not a concrete type, is it?
No, there's an interface actually on iInstanceObserver.
iInstanceObserver. Now, luckily, Josh's team here made one for us. We don't have to implement our own, but we could. It's just a much longer process than we're going to demo here. So, what I can say, oops, want my instanceObserver to equal a new stubObserver. This is a built-in implementation of that iInstanceObserver. Or iStub observer interface, right? Okay. So now that we have that, we can go ahead and invoke some operations against our system under test. Here we go. And after we hand the animal over to the zoo and listen to the animals talk again, instead of getting the animal back, we're going to get the observer back, and we're going to ask it, hey, what did the animal do? And specifically, there's a way we ask that question. And it looks like this. We assert that the observer tracked all the calls that were made. And so we ask it, what calls were made? Were there any calls made that looked like this, where the call to the stubbed method name was speak? Now, I understand that that's loosely typed. And it's a little iffy right now, frankly. Would you like to do something different than that someday?
Yeah, there might be some stuff done.
Might be some plans on that.
Maybe.
I will tell you that you can implement your own stub observers. Now, this is a mock object now, right? We just made a mock. What's interesting about that is that we've also given you the ability to create mocks because this interface is just hanging out there. And so while we have a stub observer, you might want to go create your own favorite mock types and maybe even a mocking framework built on top of stubs. And we strongly encourage you to do so. There will be a blog post either today or tomorrow, next couple of days, on Peter Provost's blog. He's our boss.
Yeah.
Talking about how to do this, talking about the deeper implementation of how to implement your own stub observer. So that's Peter Provost, and the name of his blog is Geek Noise, and you can search that up online. I'm sure it'll be fine. Yeah, we good? And I believe we left off here.
Stubs and code.
Stubs and code. All right. So here's what we learned about stubs. Well, I didn't explicitly call this out, but it's sort of implied when I am coding to an interface that that's my code. So stubs are something that I'm going to use when I own the code that I'm being faked, that's the system under test, and hopefully the interface will provide a concrete implementation of that guy. They're really quick. You don't get a big performance hit for this. As Josh told us, they're going to keep up with my compiles. No problems there. We saw how they can easily become spies. And even though we all know that we shouldn't do it, and sometimes we do, we can build a behavioral assertion model on top of that thing. That's called mock, and you can go build your own. Cool. Now the next thing.
Shims.
Shims.
Much more exciting.
You think so?
Yeah, definitely.
I don't get that.
I love the shims.
We'll see. Shims are something when shims are something to use when you're in a relationship like this. And what does that mean? Well, that means, most likely, that I'm going to have to talk to something that I don't control and that's maybe usually unavailable to me. In this case, we will look at, where'd it go? Right. Here's what I haven't mentioned. We took a dependency on this dreaded infrastructure code. See the dreaded infrastructure?
That was a mistake.
It was terrible. We didn't want to take a dependency on it, but
we had to.
Every time. Well, not only did we have to take a dependency on dreaded infrastructure because we decided to be a public zoo, but also our context is given to us through a singleton. The root of all evil, right? You know that. Singletons are the root of all evil. You can track back every war in history to singletons. So the way this guy interacts with our code makes it very difficult to test our code because we access him through that static instance, right? So let's go back over here and look at what I'm really talking about. Let's see how our zoo interacts with his own context. Where did my zoo go? Here we are. We can see that our city zoo down here has to interop with that singleton and does so just by calling that instance, gets that type back. There's only one. And the only two pieces of data that we're holding in that singleton are the open and close hours of the zoo. So not a lot of data, but you know what typically comes in on that context, right? Information about your entire runtime ecosystem, right? That's where we get to the server variables and HTTP context and all that ugly glue. So it would be really, really great if we could make a fake public facility context and pass that in. But unfortunately, not only did I take a dependency on a singleton, but look at the way I wrote that method. I didn't pass the instance in. I didn't pass the context into the method. I'm I'm just using the singleton directly. And look at the other thing I'm doing there. I am calling date time directly. So how can I possibly test this method? What do you think?
Batch file, change the server time code.
It's pretty good. You know what? This is actually a pretty gnarly little testing problem. And this morning, it turns out that the opening time of the zoo in the file on the file system, remember we were reading that off, the time the zoo opens is 9 o'clock. Well, I was testing this demo at 9 o'clock this morning. And the zoo opened okay, and it shouldn't have. Freaked me out a little. So it's real, right? You get that non-deterministic behavior when you start doing stuff like this. So what can we do? Well, if we look deep down inside this public facility context, let's look at what he's doing. Here we are. What he's doing when we ask him what is the opening and closing time is upon a static instructor goes out and gets the open and close times from a static member on a time data access repository. There's a data access repository under this thing that's holding 2 bytes of information, and they're really important. But we need to manipulate those things, and then we hang them off of the property. So let's see. What can we maybe do differently? Here's our test thus far. And did anybody notice that there was another thing down there inside that library that we generated? Anybody notice that? Let's go back and look at it. Here we are in references. Go down, open up our zoo.fakes again. And this time we see something called shims. Shims are really funny looking. What are shims?
Shims are a vehicle for runtime interception of any call.
A vehicle for runtime interception of any call. What that means, and because I'm a simpleton, you're clearly one of those smart guys. What that means to me is that I can catch any call to any .NET method in the world, and I can change what happens. I can actually just take a different route through my code. I can give my own implementation of whatever that method is. Does that sound about right?
Sounds about right.
Cool. Well, what we want to do is take advantage of that behavior. And to do so, we have to start by using a shims context. Josh, why is it that I have to do this?
It's actually fairly important. If you're going to capture calls, you definitely want to control when and when you're not redirecting calls. Shims context helps you to determine when a redirection is in scope and when it's not.
Okay, so I want to fake the call while I'm in this context, while I am in this using of this disposable thing. But when I'm done with it, don't fake out my calls anymore.
Yes.
Okay, cool, I got it. The other thing you might note is that we're going to go pull in now another namespace. See that namespace? It's up there at the top, Microsoft Quality Tools Testing Fakes. This is basically because we need a little, I hesitate to call it a runtime, but infrastructure upon which fakes sits.
Yes.
Yeah? Or the shims. So let's go ahead and finish creating up our context, and we will use it to provide an alternative date and time. Now, we have a lot of choices for where we'd like to do that. And we want to ensure that our zoo ultimately can open the gates. That's all we're really looking for. Oop, and we didn't want that to be contains. We wanted it to be true. So how are we going to, right here, have our system under test have the right data? Well, I'll tell you what I think I'd like to do is I'd like to, actually, before I do this, let's remind ourselves of what we're actually looking at. We go way down this stack, we will see in the get times, it's one up. Here we go. This guy. What we're going to do is we're going to create our own instance of datetime.now, dot hour in effect. Because in a testing environment, it's not always 9 in the morning, right? That's the whole idea. To do that, again, is not something you necessarily want to watch me type. Now look at this. Shim date time. Well, I don't have a shim to date time. But it turns out that I can shim or fake anything, including system. Ooh.
Yeah.
So tell me about this, though, Josh. Why do I have an MS Core lib?
So it turns out that the system assembly is actually made up of two assemblies, the system DLL and the MS Core lib DLL. Since we shim assemblies at the assembly level, we shim both of them when you take in the system namespace.
Cool. So that thing that we're depending on. Now, it also happens that this is pretty big,
yeah.
Right?
System's a rather large namespace.
Isn't it? It's funny how he says that. Well, I have a really sweet, hot, new, you know, Microsoft new employee laptop here, and I can tell you that it would even get bogged down occasionally as I went through this and keep gen up these big assemblies time and time again. So don't want to do it too often if we can avoid it. Now, that's one of the downsides of using shims. Shims are not something we want to have to reach into our bag of tricks and pull out very often. There's a performance overhead to this. Now, the other thing is that if we look inside our system fakes assembly, look at all the stuff that's in there. That's a lot of stuff. And it would be really, really great if we didn't have to gen all of that every time. Maybe we're only interested in shimming date time, right? So how would I do that?
Dot fix configuration file.
Okay, so it turns out that these little files that we have down here on the file system are important. Remember we talked about it being a manifest file or something like that. It's actually a set of instructions to the fakes creator, and we can tell it what to create and what not to create. And earlier today, you told me that what I might want to do is instead of starting from a position of create a shim of everything in system, which is a really expensive call, instead, we'll start from this position. Don't shim anything except what I tell you to. So I'm going to tell you to shim date time. Is that how that works?
That's correct.
Good. So now that we know we're going to get a shim for date time, if we build this again, are we going to see a different assembly?
Yes, you should.
Okay.
Let's cross our fingers.
Oh, we're still building. Boom! Uh-oh. I must have put some code in there. I did. Here, I'll just go ahead and resolve that so that we can... What's that? Ah, thank you, human compiler. No pressure. There we go. I think we got a clean build this time. Before we run this, let's go back up here and look inside the system fakes DLL. Still a bunch of stuff in there. Mm-hmm. But we're not seeing any shims, are we? We're only seeing stubs.
Just stubs.
So what we could do is we could come back in here and there's more declarative configuration that we could make that says don't make any stubs either. Or just make them in this namespace, or just don't make them in that namespace. So you can control the production of your stubs and shims. And I still love this isolation world of development, because we just added stubs and shims to the whole conversation. It's just fun terms, okay. Maybe it's me. Alrighty, so we should see this pass, and I believe we did. The zoo can open at 9. And I know that passed, or rather, let me back up just a little bit. Did you guys see that test run? Anybody see that test run? It ran, though, didn't it? It turned out it ran because of this little button right here. What, can you read that? Run tests after build. So this is a feature of the new unit test runner in Visual Studio 2012, thanks to this gentleman's team of developers, right? And what this does is every time I build my solution, I'll just go ahead and do a rebuild. there's some very smart people who told the computer where to look for what has changed most recently and make some very intelligent decisions about what code or what tests, rather, to run again. So I did not say test anything. I just said build. Every time I build, it's going to run and do my tests, and it's going to do so in such a way that's semi-intelligent so that I'm running those most important and most valuable tests first. Like if the system under test changed in a particular place and I got a piece of code that covers it, maybe that's an interesting thing to run first, that test, perhaps. Okay, so back to the shims discussion, we did pass our test. So what did we do there? We passed in a simulated time on our shimmed date time. So date time has been tamed. And this is actually a big deal for a lot of teams trying to test code that makes calls like this, because calls like this, even though we all know they stink, get made, and that's just the deal. All right, so there might be, though, another way to go about the same thing. If you looked at the calls that we were making a few moments ago, you may have noticed, let's see, that the data access repository was the thing that returned those methods. So now we're not going to shim date time, we're going to shim the other side of that conditional clause. So instead of making a fake one of these, we'll make a fake one of those. Okay. So let's just take our dependency. I've not created a fake dreaded infrastructure. So it turns out that my specification, not test project, does not even have a dependency on our dreaded infrastructure yet, so we're going to have to take a dependency on it. This is ugly. I don't want to have to do this. But that's what I have to do to get a fake one. Remember, we're not actually going to be using this thing. We're only bringing it in so that we can see what's in there and build stuff that looks like it. HTTP context. So there we go. There's that. And now we can add a fakes assembly. Now we've got our dreaded infrastructure fake. And now I can go ahead and reference that guy. And this time we're going to assert, of course, that the gates open, but that they open right now. Right? Because we're providing, if you look up here, this call. When we ask what time the zoo should open, instead of pulling that from the file system database, instead we're going to provide right now. It should be okay for us to open. So let's see if it is. Zoo can open now. Oh, no. Killed that earlier test. We're going to pretend that didn't happen. Different issue. I think we're good and can open now. There we are. Okay, so we've shimmed the other side of that problem area. We got one more place that we can play. Instead of shimming the database object, we can shim the whole context. So let's do that. Here's some code that says we want to create a shim of the singleton instance. Remember that singleton that's always a problem, the root of all evil? Well, here we're going to fake one out. So we got our very own root of all evil, and it's a shim. And through property construction, we're going to say that when a call is made to the opening hour property, to the get, return right now. Now, this is actually interesting because you may note that the property name here is not opening hour like it is on the real class. It's opening hour get. What is that an indication of? Why is that?
Say that again.
It's because these shims are diving down into your IL.
Yes.
Right? We talked about earlier how stubs don't do that. Shims do. Shims go down into your IL and change the call path, in effect. Yes?
They rewrite the IL of the assembly as it's running.
Did you hear that? They rewrite the IL of the assembly as it's running. In memory?
Yes.
In memory. Pretty cool. All right. Let's turn on this test and ensure it actually runs. And it does. So we just made our very own instance fake of HTTP context, of all of those SharePointy things that we have to take dependencies on our WebF activity context, if you happen to be a workflow developer, or any of these other things where we have these types of singleton instance classes. Oh, and by the way, one thing that really stinks and just fries me is not only when these calls are static, but what if that's a sealed class, because it seems like we just can't find a library out there that doesn't have this in it. Is it still going to work? What do you think?
I think it will.
I hope it will, too. And it did.
I like that.
So we just faked out static methods, a singleton. We faked out a sealed class. And we built a bunch of stubs based on interface contracts. And with that, it turns out you can build even higher level order things on this. That's what Josh is going to talk about. Let's see. We should probably review what we just did first. Runtime interception and detouring is sort of the big fancy name for what we just did with shims. That's getting a hold of some call in memory, routing it through a different path. We can do that with concrete classes and all these other things that have been traditionally hard to get a hold of. Even private and internal members. Even private members. Someone was asking me just yesterday at the booth about testing private methods like that. Okay, so even though we can do all this, don't. It's a bad idea. If you get here, something probably went wrong. It does, however, work very, very well if what we're trying to do is get our arms around a big pile of legacy code to create what Michael Feathers calls a seam through my system. And on this side of the seam, I might work to refactor. These shims work very, very well for that. Now, what are emulators?
So you guys might have remembered back. David mentioned that they were testing a robotic arm, and they had a nice control box. And turns out that sometimes that control box is not always easily available. For example, the Mars rover, they wanted to test the vehicle. Say they're testing the wheel. And when you're testing a wheel on a Mars rover, what you want is some good Mars dirt, right? So you go and you just say, I'm going to create some fake Mars dirt. And maybe we'll throw in a couple of fake Mars rocks, too, so that we can do that. And you start testing, you realize that, it turns out that fake Mars dirt depends on fake Mars atmosphere. So now I got to fake the Mars atmosphere. And pretty soon you start to realize, well, that means I need to fake the Mars temperature. And
we all saw Total Recall.
maybe I need to fake a few more things. And next thing I know, I'm faking a planet. So there are situations when
our tax dollars at work, by the way, that's a fake Mars.
So emulators is basically when you want to fake a planet. So generally speaking, we have the thing we are making. And then sometimes we have to live in the world where we have to live inside something that's hosting the thing we are making. So there's lots of cases, SharePoint, WF, ASP.NET. And sometimes the host that thing that we are making does all kinds of stuff. It has objects, contexts, environments, weird side effects, runtime environments, complexities for the platform. And unfortunately, sometimes we have to use those objects, contexts, and runtime environments. So what happens is I go to make one small change in the area up there on the left. But what I didn't realize is it has an effect somewhere else in the host environment that I wasn't aware of. So when I go to do my fake, my shim, it turns out that that shim needs to be aware of the effect that happened somewhere else.
So I need to be able to replicate side effects?
That would be the case if you want to fake an entire environment. What you need to do is be able to provide a fake of the unintended consequences of whatever your environment does.
Before you go too much further, this is something that we do a lot. If you're a test-driven developer, you have probably implemented your own in-memory database and repository. That's a very small example of having this ginormous implementation just for my test code. So I had that's when testing gets expensive, when I have to write my own those things.
And it can be very expensive, and the cost is very much related to how much your environment does and how well-behaved your environment is. So the solution is to create an emulator. So when your code is living inside a hard-to-test framework, the trick is to create an emulator, which is nothing more than a system of shims and stubs. So you basically try to create the minimum implementation of shims and stubs that will create the behaviors that you're trying to emulate. And in reality, they're nothing more than glue. They basically hold together shims. It's nothing more than a shim that ties the shims to call to another system of shims so that you have the entire environment replicated. So we've been looking at this area. We were interested in what is an interesting environment to emulate. Turns out that SharePoint is rather hard to test. Some people might consider it impossible to test. So it turns out the SharePoint object model is complex, interdependent, has a lot of unintended side effect driven behaviors.
We talked about in the very beginning, when code's like that, it doesn't get tested. It's just too hard and we give up.
Which is usually how people do SharePoint development. So the solution is SharePoint emulators. So they basically implement a system of shim implementations for the SharePoint 2010 server object model. And the long story short is we did the heavy lifting for you. We created the shims, we implemented the glue, we created the environment. So since code is definitely the way to go here, I'll go ahead and swap over.
Oh, wrong one.
Yeah, we're on three. Oh, wait, four. What's going on here?
Uh-oh. Well, we're looking at your machine, but I think you're you need to change your screen. I don't get it. We did a tech check right beforehand.
I need to duplicate. That's not it either. Escape. There we go.
There we are.
There we are. So as a sample app, we basically have a very simple web part. I'm not going to show you the web part. It's essentially just an appointment booker. It allows you to write in your appointments, saves them to a SharePoint list, and can recall them. It's very straightforward. The interesting thing is when you want to go testing your web part. So something that should be very basic is just a scheduled appointment returns true when you try to schedule it. So you end up writing what is essentially an integration test. So you end up calling into the site, creating your list. You create a temporary list on the actual SharePoint site. You fill in the list with some fields that you're going to need to populate it with. You prepare up your message, and then you go ahead and schedule your appointment, the actual acting on the system under test, and then you're basically asserting that it worked. So this test does run.
This is actually running on a SharePoint instance? It's an integration
test? Yeah, so right now this is basically an integration test, and you may notice that it takes almost 700 milliseconds, nearly a second to run. The interesting thing about this is that occasionally it goes up to 6 seconds. Say the SharePoint server, SQL server went to sleep. And when it comes back, it's a 6-second test, which tends to be rather long if you have a bunch of them. So SharePoint emulators helps you to escape this by using a similar strategy to the SharePoint context. You use a using statement, and you do a new SharePoint emulation scope. And you're going to pass in an emulation object, and we'll go ahead and do enabled. Then we'll go ahead and wrap my test code. In the scope. Oh, sorry. I missed parentheses. Oh, sorry. I got it. Yeah. Pair programming in action. So let's go ahead and see if we run that test.
I think it's over.
It passed rather quickly. So the long story short here is that what happened is that
I can't let you go on.
All right.
Wow. I saw somebody, this gentleman right up here in front. I believe what I saw you saying to your friend there is he doing, really, is he doing that?
That's pretty cool.
So the...
just emulated SharePoint.
So the actual under the thing is that I could go in and actually stop the SharePoint service here on my local machine. And this test would still run. It no longer has any dependency to SharePoint. It no longer makes calls that exist outside of my test framework. So all of the calls within the scope that would have gone to the SharePoint API, basically the SharePoint DLL, are now redirected to the SharePoint emulation scope. So, so we'll go down here and we'll basically show you a second test here. This is another thing. This is basically, we wrote another test to check for the appointments that when you query the list using an SP query for getting the appointments just for today. So we have the list. It does the same thing. It's a SharePoint integration test. We didn't have to change anything. You didn't have to learn a new API. You just write a SharePoint test using SharePoint APIs, which if you're a SharePoint developer, you should be roughly familiar with. So does a site, creates a new temporary list, adds fields to the list, does a little search based on date time, inserts three items into the list, does the actual action, this was all just setup code beforehand, and then verifies that we got the two items that we were looking for. So in this case, I'm going to do the SharePoint emulation scope. Save this, run this test. Uh-oh. Looks like this one's a failed test. So it turns out that while I did say that we emulate all of SharePoint, that's not entirely true. Turns out that SharePoint's very, very large, and that heavy lifting was somewhat of a large task even for us. So it turns out that there are items within the SharePoint API that we don't emulate. However, it's not the end of the world. So if you look down here at the error message that you get back, we'll get the tooltip to go away. If you come in here, you'll see something very familiar, if you're familiar with stubs and shims. Basically, it says you're missing one shim, and the shim that you're missing is splist.getItems based upon an SP query. So you think to yourself, looks like I need to add that shim in. So since this is nothing more than a library built upon fakes, no special tools, we can just fall back into the standard fakes environment. So I'll come in here and I'll copy paste my my code. I'll paste that in there. And it's pretty smart to put it in a little check, especially if you want to run these tests, say, against real SharePoint on your build server and maybe against the emulator on your dev box, so that all you have to do is change a flag and you end up with tests that run in different contexts depending upon what your needs are. So here we go in, and here's our SP list. So we new up a shim SP list. We go down here to the get item SP query, and we go ahead and implement up our shim. So to implement our shim, we simply get a new list item collection. We return the lists that we created before with the proper item that should have been selected by the SP query, and then we return it. So an interesting idea here is the bind. So bind operates on a shim. It's basically shorthand. So you could go in and manually edit in each shim property and each call to method, or you can use bind to basically check to see if there's an interface match. So if it turns out that the object that you're passing in has an interface that matches the object on the shim, it'll go ahead and do all of the wiring for you. So in this case, we have an array, which happens to implement the IEnumerable interface. And we're going to go ahead and bind that up to the SPList IEnumerable interface. And now that we have our shim implemented, we can go ahead and run all. We have a passing test at a rather 40 milliseconds, which isn't so bad. So that's the basic idea for shims on the emulator, that if you get into trouble, you run into something that we weren't able to implement, that you can create your own, basically falling back to the standard fakes and shims environment. So let's go ahead and swap back to... So the immediate next question that I'm hoping you guys are asked is, how does this help if I'm not a SharePoint developer? And the quick answer is, make your own emulators. So the SharePoint team that developed the emulators took no special dependencies. There's no extra work. There's no internal knowledge other than the fact that we know how to work fakes fairly well. That limits you from creating your own library. It's nothing more than fakes. It's just fakes. So a few of the tips that we would like to share with you guys from our experience developing SharePoint emulators is create a dual mode. Try to create a scope that determines a limitation between when your emulators run and when it runs against the real API. So at some point, you probably do want to actually test against a real SharePoint instance. If you have an emulator at some point, maybe on a build server, maybe on a nightly build, you do probably want to run a true integration test. And it's very advantageous if you can write the same tests that run locally as unit tests and run again as integration tests. So the other trick is that verification is fairly important. Unless you have expert knowledge of your environment, you need to very carefully test your emulation environment to prove that your emulators behave the same as the environment that you're replicating. So if you follow the dual mode model, it actually turns that your verification tests are rather simple to write. All you have to do is run the same test twice, once with the emulation on, once with the emulation off, and verify that the results are identical for all your critical cases. And the last point that I want to leave you guys with is you should generally prefer fast integration tests over emulation. Emulation is somewhat heavyweight and a very valuable tool if you need it and you have an environment that doesn't have any solution, for example, SharePoint, where there's no way to do a fast integration test, but it comes with cost. You can spend as much time developing your emulation environment as you do writing your code, and you want to try to do that as minimally as possible so that you do just what you need, and always keep in mind that what you're really trying to do is test your code, not write an emulator. So if you can get by with a fast integration test that meets your team's needs for speed, integration tests against real servers are better than the redirection to an emulator environment. So,
if there are any questions, there are mics right here in the middle lane. We have just a couple of minutes if anybody has anything. Yeah, please, sir, step up to the mic.
I have a question about the shims.
Okay.
Isn't that like encouraging like hacks basically into the existing behaviors? Basically, how do you prevent from an application taking advantage of such shims, basically?
I'm not sure. The shims are only valid within a tiny scope, within one single test. So when you replace the behavior with a shim behavior, it's valid only for that test and only while that test is running.
And only in the test framework, is that right?
Only for that specific unit test. So you can have a different implementation of the same shim in each context in each test. So you might have a number of shims for the same method that behave differently depending upon what unit test you're actually executing in.
Okay, thanks.
Go ahead, sir.
How would you verify that a call was made with specific arguments?
So it gets into the implementations of the stub observer. So what you need to do is actually use closures so that your parameters that get passed include the behaviors that get passed into the observer, and then the observer can basically check the parameters that get passed into. So that blog post that Peter Provost is about to post will include all the details of how to actually go about doing the closure and capturing the resulting parameters that came into your call.
Thanks.
We appreciate you guys using the mics. There's a video feed too, and that way the viewers get to hear your questions. So please, in the back, go ahead.
The shims look really useful for where, you know, we just can't get around classes that don't implement interfaces. Something that I wonder is whether Microsoft has considered on a class like Datetime or a class like TCP client, someday will Datetime implement an iDateTime so that we don't need to do the shimming?
That is it's a very interesting question, and I would really have to defer to the CLR team. So
put in a plug for it, please.
Yeah, I'll follow up with them.
It wouldn't help you if it's a static method.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, do you guys have any guidance as to how to test like asynchronous operations, especially like using shim and the await operators and things like that?
Do you want to jump in?
Well, testing async is a whole thing, and I'll tell you what, we're going to cover it a little bit tomorrow in a talk I'm doing at 10.
Okay.
If you're interested in that, I'm not going to spend the entire talk on testing async, but we will address it a little bit. Do you have any particular tips that you would
I don't have anything specific. It's a
Await is your friend, that's for sure. it's hard, man. We'll get there, though. Yes, sir, in the back.
Hi. Any plans for other emulators than SharePoint, like CRM or?
Yes, we have plans, but nothing to announce.
How about ideas?
Yeah, I would call it ideas. We have lots of ideas.
Yeah, would you accept community input for emulators?
Yeah, we actually strongly like this last slide is create your own emulators. We would strongly support the idea of community generated emulators. They don't need any special dependence, just fakes. So if you can run fakes, you can run an emulator. There's nothing stopping it.
If you have ideas about this, Josh wants to hear from you.
Yeah,
his email address is right there.
It's very much true.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I have a Windows 8 app, and when the search fires, it fires an event. So I want to hook in and kind of test that I'm handling that event properly. Is that an emulator or a shim, or what exactly, how would I hook in, fire an event that the operating system would otherwise fire?
That would be a shim, but your specific occasion is actually Windows 8, which Fakes doesn't currently support Windows 8 apps. So it requires a bit more work to get the Windows 8 runtime environment into the shared generation.
Okay, thanks.
In the back.
Do you have a WCF emulator?
No, right now all we have is a SharePoint emulator, but as you see my emails there, definitely send me suggestions for if you want emulators in the future.
Do shims support pinvoke, and do you stop support pinvoke and COM interfaces?
Ooh, that's a good question.
That's a good one.
I'm not totally sure.
That will be useless if it doesn't support for a lot of legacy applications.
For a deep tech question like that, I'm going to have to ask you to email me. I will follow up and get you the answer.
Yes, sir.
Hi. So my question, it sounds like it's probably already directly answered, and if so, then I'll just ask the second one. So the first one was, is there an emulator for the Windows Store application suite? And it sounds like the answer is no if you've only done SharePoint, which therefore leads directly to the ancillary question, which is, where do we need to subscribe to hear what emulators are available, and are they going to be available as download plugins to the quality tools?
So the SharePoint emulators will be, I probably should have mentioned this, they'll be released as part of the Visual Studio 2012 Update 1. I hope most of you are familiar that Visual Studio is now having quarterly updates. So the best place is actually the Visual Studio ALM blog, where we very frequently update what is coming in the future updates.
Actually, if you open Visual Studio today, there's a start page, and that start page, there's a set of videos that show you features that are in your new version of Visual Studio in 2012. There's a video about testing your code with shims and stubs. So we'll not only announce it here, but when you get a new version of Visual Studio, you're going to have a little bit of help in finding those new features and using them.
Okay. By the way, sorry, quickly.
Yeah,
kudos for taking TDD seriously, guys. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Any complications faking up interop assemblies?
Yeah, it's the internals of fakes are quite complicated, and the interop assemblies are especially hard for us. We do basically runtime generation of code on the IL, and the interop libraries have some troubles, especially with the differences between the 4.0 and the 4.5 changes. That's fixed generally. Works, but there are some slight technical problems where the interop assemblies are not always perfectly generated. So there's a few times around interop that we do actually fail. But a lot of those are limitations around the CLR and how you can do IL generation for some stuff.
Okay, with the emulators, why are they running so slow? You showed a performance increase there, but still 600 milliseconds is still very long for a unit test.
I would say that the majority of my slowness here is that I'm remoting into a VM that's running in my office that's running a couple of other VMs. So the slowness is really the slowness of the machine, not necessarily the fakes. Once you do the emulators, you get pretty close to shim level performance, which does have a performance impact from. Stubs are compiled, so they run basically at code speed. There's almost no delay. Shims have to do an IL interception of the call and do some cleanup and injection there, so that there is a slight delay. But emulator should be pretty fast. I don't have any specific numbers.
So will we be able to see like the 10 millisecond times that you had
earlier? I would say that in our general experience when we're doing SharePoint emulation code from the SharePoint emulators, we get somewhere around maybe 2 to 3 to maybe an order of magnitude difference for running the integration test versus the emulation test. It all depends upon what you're actually emulating. The SharePoint APIs, some of them are fast, some of them hit databases and have complex SQL calls and stuff like that. So it's hard to make generalizations. But in general, we usually see at least 2 to 3 times faster.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you all very much.